If I had my life to live over, how many sermons do you suppose have been preached under that title? How many quietly spoken regrets have been exchanged in somebody's living room to friends close enough to understand? Most of the time we say it with a sigh, hinting that we are wiser now, and that if we could start all over again, we'd make fewer mistakes, do a little better, waste less time. But once in a while, somebody says the opposite, that life was taken much too seriously, that it slipped by without enough laughter, and that if there were another chance, there'd be more happiness this time and a little less worry. I heard a California physician read a humorously exaggerated version of that idea one morning, and he gave me, at my request, a copy. It goes like this. If I had my life to live over, I'd try to make more mistakes next time. I would relax. I would limber up. I would be sillier than I have been this trip. I know of very few things I would take seriously. I would be crazier. I would be less hygienic. I would take more chances. I would take more trips. I would climb more mountains, swim more rivers, and watch more sunsets. I would eat more ice cream and fewer beans. I would have more actual problems and fewer imaginary ones. You see, I'm one of those people who live prophylactically and sensibly and sanely, hour after hour, day after day. Oh, I have had my moments, and if I had to do it all over again, I'd have more of them. In fact, I'd have nothing else, just moments, one after the other, instead of living so many years ahead of each day. I've been one of those people who never go anywhere without a thermometer, a hot water bottle, a gargle, a raincoat, and a parachute. If I had it to do over again, I would go places and do things and travel lighter than I have. If I had my life to live over, I would start barefoot earlier in the spring and stay that way later in the fall. I would play hooky more. The children are not here. I wouldn't make such good grades, except by accident. I would ride on more merry-go-rounds. I'd pick more daisies. Well, it's hyperbole, of course, and the man who read it didn't believe every single word of it and counted on us to have a sense of humor. But the fact is that we do get too solemn, take ourselves too seriously, get too busy to do all sorts of things we'd really like to do until it's too late to do them. There's a great deal of sense in that piece, including the remark that one should make good grades only by accident. That is, good grades should happen because you're aiming at knowledge, at learning things, and not aiming at grades. And grown-ups do need to be a little silly and crazy at times and watch more sunsets and not lose today by living so many years ahead of it. I remarked to my friend the physician that he'd been a high achiever all his life, had worked very hard to hone his professional skills, and that except for a minor change here and there, despite this charming romantic piece he had just read to us, he would probably live his life over again just about the way he had lived it. He laughed and agreed with me. But I liked the touch of nostalgia in him and the rueful sense that he had missed something. What about the other side? What about those of us who, instead of succeeding, as he did, fail too often and mess our lives up with short tempers or loose tongues or weak wills? Would we do much better if we had our lives to live over again? If we had the romantic second chance that people dream about sometimes? Or would it come out about the same? Which brings me to what I called last week in the trailer the most important question a person can ask about character. Has my life been less than I wanted it to be because of accident, or the ill will of others, or has it been less because of me, because of what I am? If I got a second chance and went round again, would it really be so different after all, unless somehow I were changed myself? The Bible, you should not be surprised to find out, looks at both sides of that question. One of the old prophets by the name of Jeremiah doubted very much that some of the people he knew would do any better. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? Jeremiah thought there was about that much chance that some of his contemporaries could ever be any different. But not everybody who appears in the biblical story felt that way. John the Baptist thought people could change and told them in a voice of thunder that they had better. And Christ believed in a second chance, although he spoke of it more gently. You have to change and become like little children in order to enter the kingdom of right relationships. The Gospel of John speaks of it as a kind of new birth. So would we all turn out the same way again, even if we had a second chance, as Jeremiah thought in his moment of anger? Or would some of us do better, as Christ hoped? Or does the truth slide back and forth between those two opinions? I thought you might enjoy this morning seeing how a Scotch playwright by the name of J.M. Barrie wrestles with that eminently Christian problem. Barrie's name may not ring a bell as the author of an amusing play about British social life called The Admirable Crichton, but you'll feel a little closer to him, I think, to learn that he wrote Peter Pan, which everybody knows, either from having read the play or having seen Mary Martin fly across the stage on Broadway or in a movie or on television. Or if by some miracle we missed all that, then Peter Pan is familiar because he smiles at us, all decked out in a pointed green cap and red freckles from 100,000 peanut jars. So we owe that familiar character to J.M. Barrie. But he wrote another play, which I like better than either of the ones I mentioned, a play called Dear Brutus, with its title stolen from a couple of lines in Shakespeare, which sum up what Barrie wants us to believe about life. Barrie liked to get at reality by writing fantasy, and that's how Dear Brutus works. When the curtain goes up, we discover that a group of people have gathered in a big house occupied by a strange little man whose name is Lob. If we know a little English folklore, we catch on right away that this is going to be an unusual play because Lob is one of the names given to Puck, that mischievous sprite who also shows up in A Midsummer Night's Dream. In fact, the very next thing we learn is that our play is taking place on Midsummer Eve, when according to ancient superstition, all kinds of strange things happen to people. When we first meet the house guests, the women are off by themselves, and they have cooked up a scheme to embarrass the butler of the place, whose name is Matey, and who has already stolen rings from three of them. He thinks they don't know this. They ask him to take a telegram to the post office, but they insist that he read the message aloud before he goes. When he does, it says, "To police station, send officer first thing in morning to arrest Matey, butler, for theft of rings." He's embarrassed, of course, quickly takes the rings out of his pocket, returns them, and hopes the case is closed. But they insist that as part of the price of their forgiveness, he has to tell them what it is that they all have in common. Since the owner of the house, Lob, has hinted that this is why they were all invited on this particular night. Matey begs the women not to make him tell what Lob is up to, and he pleads his own case by saying that all our lives are determined by certain turnings, by little tricks of fate, and that if he had just taken a different turning, things would be better. So we know what Matey represents, the almost universal human tendency to blame circumstances rather than our own characters for what we become. "If I had only taken the clerkship that was offered to me once," Matey tells them, "I'd be the most honest man alive today." He really believes this. He warns the women not to go into a certain nearby forest, which has magical qualities he can only hint at. The men come in at this point from another room, and we discover that they too think their lives would have been quite different if only the circumstances had been changed. This is what all the guests have in common: the conviction that fate is to blame. One would have written a book if only he had been poor enough to feel compelled to write it. Another is Mr. Purdy, a philanderer, who blames first one thing and then another for his endless, shallow flitting from one woman to another. And there is Mr. Dearth, who was once a promising artist, but who began to drink and lose his talent when he felt that his wife had lost faith in him. And there is his wife, who blames everything bad in her character from having had the misfortune to marry him. He's the man in the play who happens to draw back a curtain in the house, look out at the garden, and then let the curtain fall back like someone who has just gotten a very bad shock. He is so grave when he turns back to the others that even his wife is impressed. He insists on knowing what is in that garden, which had suddenly turned into a forest, and the little man, Lob, is forced to tell his guests that it is a magical wood, that to go into it is to find what everybody longs for, the miracle of a second chance with life. So, of course, they all go into it, in one way or another, including Matey, the butler, who is shoved out of the house by his master. When we meet the characters there in the forest in the second act, Matey has already gotten his second chance. He is now extremely wealthy, although his manners and his language are not improved at all. We also discover that although he did take that clerkship in this second time around and is now driving a Rolls Royce, he is still a thief. Only now, instead of stealing small personal items like rings, he is stealing from huge corporations and from national banks. Into a changed set of circumstances, he has taken his own unchanged character, and so nothing is really different. As one of the characters puts it, it's not fate. Fate is something outside us. What really plays the Dickens with us is something in ourselves, something that makes us go on doing the same sort of fool things however many chances we get. The philanderer, Mr. Purdy, is at it again, chasing a different woman this time, but using the same tricks and the same language and feeling just as sorry for himself. One has the sense that he may be doomed to be this kind of man forever, no matter in what life he finds himself. The same is true of several others, but the playwright is too much of a romantic not to make a little good news out of all of this. The gospel is in this play, in other words, or I would not be preaching it. Dearth, the man who once had hope as a painter, is now painting. And with him is the daughter he never had but always wanted, and he is sublimely happy. His wife, who was so sure before she went into the wood that things were bad for her because she chose poorly in marriage, now chooses wrong again. And when she returns to the house, is in far worse state than when we first met her. But she and her husband both now recognize what they caused to happen out of what they are in themselves, and they are the one pair for whom the playwright seems to have a real glimmer of hope. There are critical Christian themes held up in this play. It stresses the importance of self-knowledge and the willingness to admit that the mistakes one makes in life are more likely to have come from flaws in the personality than from accidents of fate. The play is realistic enough to know that most of us will not change, but it is hopeful enough to think that some of us may. Is there ever any permanent effect, one character asks? Once in a while, Lobb admits, and in that quiet statement shines the hope which Barry could never quite abandon and which Jesus made the centerpiece of his gospel, that we can change. But it only happens when, instead of shifting the blame endlessly, we find courage to say the words from which Barry took his title and his theme. You may remember, some of you, the context: Cassius and Brutus in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, talking about Caesar himself, a man inferior in many ways to both of them, but to whom they now seem destined to bow down and worship as if he were a god. Cassius especially doesn't like it, and he blames the two of them for not doing anything about it. Men, he says, at some times are masters of their fates. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Taking the blame. It may be the toughest confession in the world to make. But if the magical wood of the second chance is to make any difference, it's the first step.